Hi, I'm Scott Jagow. As a kid, I was told to save my money. Have I done that? Not so much. Maybe I should have taken some lessons.
We needed to quit being a preacher, if you will, and show people actually how they could start making changes in their financial habits.
The three words that best describe holiday office parties this year: stink, stank, stunk. The Grinch will make sure nobody throws a bash. You'll be lucky to get a candy cane on your desk, especially on Wall Street.
Well, if you're taking the taxpayers' money, you really can't put on a lavish celebration for yourself.
That story and more coming up as we continue our coverage of the financial crisis fallout. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, this is Marketplace Money. Personal finance boils down to three things: spending, investing, and saving. Most people are pretty good at spending. It's those other two that are a little shaky. But while you might be born to spend, saving is something you have to learn how to do. I'm Scott Jagow, in for Tess Vigeland. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider that offers products and planning tools to help their nearly 3 million members and their communities thrive. More at thrivent.com.
It appears a lot of people have quit their spending habit for now. In October, retail sales had their biggest drop on record. We all know the stores are going to suffer this holiday season, but how bad can it possibly be? Here to help us figure it out is our own retail maven, Stacey Vanek Smith. Stacey, what's the forecast?
It's going to be terrible. Just to give you an example, last year consumers spent about $460 billion during the holiday shopping season. This year, that's expected to go down by about 1%. Now, that doesn't sound that bad, but that number never goes down. In fact, the last time it went down was the early 90s, and the last time it's gone down that much was the early 80s.
Wow. Now, what are retailers doing to respond to this to try to get anyone to come shop?
Sales. They are launching huge sales. I mean, everyone from Nordstrom's to Macy's to Ann Taylor, we're seeing 30% off, 40% off. And these are sales that we usually don't see until after Christmas. And that's really bad because retailers count on profits that they make during the holidays for the whole year. Often 80% of their profits for the whole year come from this time of year.
I keep hearing, well, Walmart's doing okay. You know, everybody's stinking up the joint except Walmart.
Right.
Is that really true?
It is, actually. The only people that are really sort of doing okay in this downturn are super deep discounters that are offering sales on top of their discounts. But even they are not necessarily doing as well as they should be. I spoke with Bert Flickinger. He's a retail analyst. And he said even the sales at the big discounters aren't as high as they should be right now.
There aren't any clear winners. And the more people who report, the worse it's going to get. And the consumer's more cash and credit constrained than ever before.
So even the Walmarts of the world are getting crunched.
Stacey, I was watching TV the other day, and I noticed that the ads that have come out so far for holiday sales seem very kind of gooey, trying to get that Christmas spirit evoked in people. What else besides dropping the price are retailers doing?
A couple of things. Price drops are obviously the big one because people just can't spend on credit this year. So a lot of stores are really promoting programs like layaway, where you can spend money but don't necessarily have to count on your credit card. A lot of huge sort of personalized promotions to loyal shoppers. People are getting a lot of discount cards or special sales events, basically anything to sort of get people in the store. And they figure once they're in the store, they'll buy things.
And what kind of effect will this have on the economy as a whole?
Well, the real trickle-down effect that we're going to see is the job market. About 10% of Americans are actually employed in the retail sector. And actually, a quarter of the layoffs that we've seen since last November have been in retail. That's more than even the automotive sector. So it's really been hit. And the real problem with that is that retail jobs are sort of a go-to place for workers without college educations. They're considered the most vulnerable during economic downturns. And so it's really bad news when those jobs start drying up, because that's really been a place for people who've lost jobs in manufacturing, younger workers, people with fewer skills, they've all gone to the retail sector traditionally.
I think it's going to be an old-fashioned Christmas.
Yes, yes, the kind with no gifts.
All right, Stacey Vanek Smith, thanks.
Thanks, Scott.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider that offers products and planning tools to help their nearly 3 million members and their communities thrive. More at thrivent.com. And by Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act.
I have it on good authority that Santa Claus is still planning to make his run this year. He never takes a year off. But he is concerned about the costs facing parents. Beyond feeding the kids and clothing them, they're saving for college, that's a biggie, and daycare. The cost of childcare is outpacing inflation. And that leaves parents with a tough call. Find more money or find another way to care for their children. Jamie Bedrin has this story from New York.
Got $15,000? You'll need it in most parts of the U.S. if you're going to put an infant into full-time daycare for a year. Julie Landweber and her husband are professors in New Jersey. She says the cost of keeping their son in daycare is higher than tuition at her husband's college. Daycare gobbles up 10% of their income, and it's making it hard for them to save.
We've always been very good savers, and he's been in this daycare now for a little over a year, and we saved almost no money last year outside of retirement.
High costs have ruled out daycare for Jennifer Laughlin and her partner, Kate. Jennifer is a librarian in Washington, D.C. Kate teaches. Jennifer says daycare wasn't out of the question with one child. Then they had their second.
Should we have both kids in daycare, or what are our other options? And when we looked at the cost of the daycare for two kids, it was staggering.
Laughlin says the cost wipes out one salary almost entirely. It made more sense for one of them to stay home with the kids. But Laughlin says supporting a family on a librarian's pay is a challenge.
It does impact both the way that we live day to day, and it also is a stressful thing.
The family is now living on a tight budget. They clip coupons and buy generic cereal. They're even babysitting a few days a week to help make ends meet. Mark Gavigan wouldn't even consider private childcare. He's a day trader in New Jersey. His wife's a consultant. They've planned their schedules so that one of them is always home with the couple's two daughters.
All the time, I think, boy, if I had more hours a week to put into my business efforts, I would be much more successful. But at the same time, the dividends that we receive from this arrangement, while not helping us financially, are helping us in every other way.
None of these people feel that childcare professionals should be paid less. They do a vital job in raising kids. But for people with modest incomes, the cost of private childcare is becoming impossible to absorb. Julie Landweber, the professor, believes daycare teaches kids valuable social skills. She likes the idea of a public preschool or national daycare like they have in other countries.
I also think that it should be partially or fully taxpayer covered, and that would mean higher taxes, but I think that we would benefit as a society from it.
But there are no plans in the works for any kind of public daycare, which means Landweber and others like her will have to continue to pay up if they want to work full-time and have children. Landweber says she's looking forward to her son's first day of kindergarten. It's free. In New York, I'm Jamie Bedrin for Marketplace Money.
This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media.
Ready or not, here I come. Wait, I gotta tie my shoe. Please, can you play with me? Wake me up, cause I snore. Hide and seek, close your eyes. I can do magic tricks. My middle name is Kevin. I would love a playmate. Say what's on your mind.
What about 10 it got left behind?
Yeah, what about 10? It's a friend of mine.
What about 10? Just one more time.
This week, the Treasury Secretary changed his game plan. He's not going to buy up those awful mortgage-backed securities from the banks anymore, but he would like to help lenders and credit card companies unlock more consumer credit. It's time for the Straight Story with Chris Farrell. Chris, I still feel like the people are missing from this equation.
We're still obsessed about the banks. And yes, Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson has made this flip-flop where he's focusing more on consumer lending, but he's still not focusing on the homeowner. And as long as you have these big foreclosures, there's going to be downward pressure on prices, because think of what happens when a home goes in foreclosure. Then it deteriorates, the price goes down, that puts further downward pressure in the neighborhood, and you have a lot of ad hoc actions being taken. But the bottom line is, the real story of this crisis is that we need systemic conclusions, the fancy word for saying solutions that are more across the board.
Does this mean just kind of pushing money toward the problem, or do you have something specific in mind we can do?
Well, I think there are two things we can do. I mean, my favorite solution has long been, let's change the bankruptcy code. Allow for the modification of mortgages in the bankruptcy system. Let people go bankrupt, go before a judge, toss out the debts that they can't pay, and change the terms of the mortgage for people who that's the right solution. They stay in their home, and everyone eats it a little bit. That's what I'd like to see. There's another very good solution out there, and Sheila Bair is the head of the FDIC, and she has a $40 billion proposal. She wants to tap into this $700 billion fund of money that's been set aside to sort of have more of a modification of mortgage terms. And if we can't change the bankruptcy system, I say let's do that. But we have to focus on the homeowner, because if we don't focus on the homeowner, we're not going to see an end to this crisis anytime soon.
But hasn't Paulson said he won't use the money for that particular purpose?
Yes, and he also said that he wouldn't buy stock in financial services companies, and he changed his mind right there. And he also said, if you don't pass this $700 billion bill so that we can buy these toxic assets out of these companies, everything's going to fall apart.
Now he's talking about buying up the consumer debt market. That's a big shift.
Exactly. And
yeah, I mean, obviously, he's changed his mind once again. But that's a big shift there, Chris. Do you think that that's going to work?
It'll do a little bit. It's actually, at this point, I'm starting to get uncomfortable. When American Express turns itself into a bank and then it's applying for a bailout because it's got these credit card losses, it makes me uncomfortable. This is why I would really like to see a very fast, very quick overhaul the bankruptcy system, because if people are having trouble with their credit cards and they need to default on their debt, I mean, let them go into bankruptcy court. I'm very nervous about this shift of trying to shore up the auto loan lenders, shore up the credit card lenders, trying to get them to do more lending. And I think we need to focus on the people.
Yeah, and the biggest problem I think a lot of people have with this change is that you're talking about going back to what caused this in the first place.
I mean, exactly,
which is opening up credit so that people can buy things they can't afford.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. You just hit the problem with what's being proposed right now. I don't know what the ideological problem is at this point, but you know what? Let's focus on the homeowner.
Okay, Chris, that's the best we can do today.
Can't solve this.
Right. Chris Farrell with The Straight Story. Thanks.
Thanks.
We'll talk to Chris later in the show for Getting Personal. That's when we answer your money questions. But first, getting your finances in order can hurt a little. Skipping the latte, movie rentals instead of theaters. But it can be very satisfying if you can stay disciplined.
And I feel pride when they look at my accounts. Before, it was embarrassing.
No pain, no gain. Coming up on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Scott Jagow, in for Tess Figland. We've always been told to save for a rainy day. Well, in case you haven't noticed, it's coming down pretty hard right now. And the problem is, most people didn't save. In fact, the average household is more than $9,000 in debt. 20% of our incomes goes to paying that off every month instead of going into a savings account. But there is help out there. People trying to resurrect the lost art of saving. Marketplace Money's Eve Tro reports.
Okay, time to fess up. That hot pink dress you never wore, that treadmill that turned into a clothes rack, what did it cost? Come on, you can tell me. Or you can tell the whole world at spendster.org.
Coffee maker is spotless. As you can see, it has never been used. That's why. And we'll look over here. Golf clubs. Nice, right? guess who doesn't play golf?
Spendster users upload video confessions about overbuying, like this one. A ticker adds up all the money wasted, more than $200,000 so far, and the site's only been up a couple weeks. The stories are all too relatable.
They make us squirm because we're all spendsters.
Ted Beck is CEO of the National Endowment for Financial Education. He started Spendster. The idea was born on a coffee break. Beck mentioned a drawer at home full of unused stuff, and he wondered how much it was all worth. Everyone chimed in with their own stories.
It went from a drawer to a closet to a garage, and we all were kind of laughing and outdoing each other. We were all learning from it. This wasn't a sort of a little secret that each of us had.
The site adds a moral to these tales of consumption. You enter what you spent on something you didn't need, and it tells you what you'd have now if you'd invested or saved that money. That $25 on coffee last week, it could have been $120 for retirement. Again, Ted Beck.
Our goal is to turn that into a teachable moment where we can bring back the idea of living within your income.
It's a show-don't-tell approach, and more people are adopting it. Sites like SmartyPig.com. It's an internet bank with a social networking twist. You start an online savings account with a goal in mind, a vacation, an iPod, textbooks. Friends and family can chart your progress or even help you out, but you only get the cash when you meet the goal. Musette Bracker is a vice president at Government Employees Credit Union in El Paso, Texas. She says turning a spender into a saver is a long process. She compares it to dieting.
We all try diets on our own. It's just too hard to do. But put it in a group setting, put it in a competitive type setting, and the results are amazing.
Bracker started a savings challenge program in El Paso last year. It's like the reality show The Biggest Loser, but with saving money instead of losing weight. 6 credit union customers get personal training for their pocketbooks and check in over a year to measure progress. The winner gets $10,000, and the stories are all documented on local TV, in English and in Spanish.
El ahorro GZU Saving Challenge 07.
No he tenido tentación de activar una tarjeta nueva.
Gloria Aguilar, a 53-year-old single mom, had about $30,000 in credit card debt when she started the savings challenge.
I was living paycheck to paycheck. As a matter of fact, at the beginning of the savings challenge, I think that I bounced like 3 checks. And at that point, I wanted to give up.
The contest made her take a hard look at her spending. $500 a month on fast food, impulse buys. She took a second job and chipped away at those bad habits. By the end of the year, Aguilar paid almost all the debt, and she won the challenge. Now she smiles at the tellers in the credit union.
And I feel pride when they look at my accounts. Before, it was embarrassing.
Creator Musette Bracker says the contest is more than a feel-good thing, though. It's a research tool. Contestants like Gloria Aguilar prove that it's not that people don't want to save. They never learned how.
Regardless of education, income, they don't know where to start. And it really told us that we needed to quit being a preacher, if you will, and show people actually how they could start making changes in their financial habits.
Bracker believes financial educators and financial institutions need a makeover of their own. If they relate to people's money problems instead of punishing them, more will come back into the savings fold. Then the coffee break conversation might be about how much we're saving, not how much we're wasting. In Los Angeles, I'm Eve Troe for Marketplace Money.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider that offers products and planning tools to help their nearly 3 million members and their communities thrive. More at thrivent.com. And by Gather.com. If it's happening in the world, it's being discussed on Gather. People are talking about the economy at Gather.com. Marketplace Money is supported by FINRA Investor Education Foundation, helping inform today's investor through innovative grant-making and educational funding. Online at finrafoundation.org.
If you're looking to start saving more, the banks will be happy to have you. A lot of them are offering sign-up bonuses if you open a new account, cash back, airline tickets, a number of other perks. But beware, bank fees are on the rise. So if you're not paying close attention, they could get you in the end. Here to talk about it is Greg McBride, a senior analyst at Bankrate.com. Greg, are these fee increases mainly about banks needing capital at the moment?
Fees have been going up consistently for 10 years. The current troubles in the financial sector just underscore the reliance that many institutions have on fee income. And it's certainly not going to reverse this trend anytime soon. But the fact is, even if everything was sunshine and daffodils in the financial sector, we'd still be talking about how fees have hit the new record levels.
And where are we seeing these increases? What fees are going up?
The best examples are punitive-type fees, things like bounce check fees, ATM fees. If you go to another bank's ATM, very often that involves paying not just one, but two fees, both of those on the increase, both the fee assessed by the ATM owner as well as the fee assessed by your own bank for going to another ATM. And then monthly service charges on interest checking accounts. Not only are the fees going up, but the balance required to avoid that fee is also going up. And those are consistent with trends that we've seen time and time again over the last decade.
And on those interest-bearing accounts, is it worth it to do that with the fees being so high?
Let me give you another alternative that I think is much better for the vast majority of consumers. Free checking is widely available. Now, very often this is a non-interest account, but what defines free checking is an account that does not charge you a fee regardless of your balance or your activity. So the reality of it is you can free up a large balance that you'd otherwise be stranding in a low-yielding interest checking account by moving to a non-interest free checking account that doesn't have a balance requirement. You're not going to incur any fees, and now suddenly that large balance you'd been stranding in the interest checking account is free to be deployed in a more efficient manner, such as in a high-yield savings account where you can get a better rate of return.
Of course, with the interest-bearing account, you are making a little bit of money off of that, and it does give you some incentive to keep the balance at a certain amount. Seems like that would be a good thing.
Well, but there's a huge opportunity cost there. The average return on an interest checking account is about 0.25%. And on average, you have to keep about $3,500 in the account just to avoid fees. So you're effectively stranding $3,500 to earn 0.25% rate of interest just so you don't get socked with a $12 monthly fee, which is the average. You slip up just 1 month, you pay a $12 fee. How many months' worth of interest does that wipe out on that $3,500 balance?
A lot of this is obviously common sense. Are there any things, though, that people kind of forget about in terms of getting assessed these fees?
Well, a couple things. I mean, you know, in the era of bouncing checks, for example, there may be policies in place whereby the largest check is cleared first. If multiple payments arrive on the same day, there's not a sufficient balance to cover them all. And that may result in the dominoes falling on and bouncing several other smaller payments, and that could lead to more fees. Again, it's a policy to be aware of, but it's one that you can completely avoid just by making sure that you have enough money in the account to cover all those upcoming transactions.
Greg McBride, he's a senior analyst at Bankrate.com. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
It's time for Getting Personal, part of the show where we take your personal questions. And no, I don't mean those kind. Personal finance questions. Chris Farrell is with us once again. Hi, Chris.
How you doing, Scott?
I'm doing okay. Our first caller is Audrey, who is with us from Minnesota. Hi, Audrey.
Hello.
I understand that you are on a church finance committee.
That's right.
What kind of business do you have to conduct as being a member of a church finance committee?
We look at the overall income and expenses for our parish and school and try to make wise decisions about how to handle those finances.
And how is your church doing financially?
We're doing well. It's a parish that really gives. We've received some major gifts here recently.
And I know that is part of your question, so ask Chris your question about that situation.
Okay. We know that we're about to receive a major gift, the biggest one we've ever received. It'll be about $3 million, and we are trying to decide how to handle that wisely.
What kinds of things might she think about, Chris?
One of the things that I think is extremely important, because lots of people want to manage this money for you, what are the fees that they're going to charge? And fees are extremely important because you make your guesstimates about what future returns are going to be. But that's kind of the beneficence of the gods, right? With fees, you know what your fee is going to be, and it compounds over a period of time. So fees are very important.
And Audrey, I understand that you were wondering whether you should go with a big national bank since it's such a big amount of money or stick with a local bank.
Yes, we are having a little difference of opinion. Some people feel that given the down market right now, we should put this in very conservative investments like bank CDs. There's a concern that if we receive this gift, its value will be lost almost immediately if it goes into the market.
And I think that's legitimate. That's a real concern. And that's where I would lean partially on diversification, which during a times of crisis doesn't protect you that much. With this money, you might want to invest more in the fixed income, the safe part of the fixed income market, reduce the percentage that is in equities, but definitely not eliminate it. So I have no real ability to say whether you should be 70% fixed income or 30% equities or 50-50. But I do think with the money coming in that you want to preserve the principal plus return, you're going to want to have a diversified portfolio, but I would lean toward the conservative direction in the current environment that we're in. But you don't want to be getting into the market timing business very much either. So it's sort of, I think the discussion that you're having is really a good one. And what it's really honing in on is how much risk do you want to take with this portfolio? So you want to come up with an asset allocation that, to a large extent, works for you in all markets and all climates. I think it's a safe forecast. Now, you can call me back in a year or two and say, Chris, we did have a Great Depression and you were wrong. I hope that we don't have that conversation. I do think that the economy will recover. I think that the market will recover. My safe forecast is there will be another bear market.
All right, Audrey, does that help?
It does a lot. Thank you.
Well, best of luck to you.
Thanks.
Well, Chris, we seem to be getting a lot of questions from Minnesota this week. We have another one from Evelyn. Her company is in its budgeting cycle for next year, and she's thinking about the IRS mileage rate and what to recommend in terms of budgeting because gas prices have come down so much. What do you think? What do you think the IRS might do in this situation?
You're asking me not only to predict what's going to happen, but what the IRS is going to do?
It's getting personal.
All right. Now, if I've done the math right, so last year, gas prices were up about 30%, and the IRS said you can increase the mileage rate by, drum roll please, 4%. So we've had a plunge in gas prices. I would put a 4% decline because it looks like maybe that's the ratio that they're working with. It would be a fairly small decline, so I would knock it down by, say, 4 or 5%, and you're probably in the right range.
So that works out to be about, what, 8 cents?
8 cents, something like that.
I guess that's the best you can do in terms of thinking, that far in advance. But if things stay the way they are, I'm sure the IRS is going to make some kind of move.
They will make a move, and they will make a move on the downside, or at least, they will cut the rate.
Yeah, hopefully the IRS isn't listening, and we'll just leave it the way it is.
That's right.
All right, that's all the time we have right now for questions, but we'll come back with more in a little while. In the meantime, you can leave us a voicemail message anytime at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONY. Or you can write us an email. Find the Getting Personal link on our website, marketplace.org. We'll be back with more Getting Personal in just a bit. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I don't know if worker productivity will suffer from this, but this week YouTube announced a deal to show full-length movies. They'll come from MGM's archives. Smash hits like Chuck Norris in Lone Wolf McQuade. I think I'll get back to work. On this week's Day in the Work Life, we meet somebody who doesn't worry about where people watch movies, but where the movies take place.
My name is Nancy Haker. I'm a location manager for the television show House, and I'm 45 years old. You get a script. You outline the locations that you need.
Hey, Ben. How are you, honey?
How are you doing, darling?
And then you go out and you look for those.
I have another episode. I actually have two episodes that
two
I think...
Two episodes?
Yeah. I think they're going to play here, both of them.
our schedule, we have an 8-day shoot and an 8-day prep. So in a perfect world, we would get that script at least 8 days before we start shooting. If I'm looking for a house, for a character, for one of our episodes, I would love to show my production designer 8 to 10 to 12 houses that I think work. Cuddy is a character on our show, and we shot Cuddy's house. We removed all the furniture. We repainted. We took out the light fixtures. We addressed the shrubbery. We took all anything that looked Los Angeles out or wrapped it up. Now you have all these people and all these trucks on the street, so the whole neighborhood has to be on board with you. We offer compensation for just about everything. If I'm going to do an interior of your house, I want a full day shoot, let's say a 12-hour shoot day, I would probably start with $5,000. If you're there overnight, it's very late, people will want to be put up, we'll get them the hotel room, we'll figure out how to get them there, and then there's all those little things like per diem for the day, and their dog needs to be put up, and their leaf blower needs to go away for the day, and so it starts to add up. I like feature work. Just last year I did Into the Wild, and we were out in the environment. We did the Grand Canyon. We did border crossings in Mexico, and that preparation was months. So you're scouting months ahead of shooting. It's more about the aesthetics, and you can use your imagination, and you can usually reach far and wide. We were prepping for the feature Phone Booth. Now, Phone Booth is supposed to be set in New York, but we're shooting it in Los Angeles. And we had been prepping Fifth Street, and we had spent months going from merchant to merchant because we want to close it down for a 10-day shoot. And all of a sudden, we get a phone call, and there's a glitch. A lot of merchants from the jewelry district are voicing their opinion, and at the end of that meeting, we don't have Fifth Street. But what the film office did was say, okay, you can have 6th Street. We literally walked out of that meeting, walked over to 6th Street, and any business that was open, we just started signing them up. Location managers can make, anywhere from, I'm going to say $80,000 a year to several hundred thousand a year. Generally speaking, features will pay better than television. I do love this job. It just opens the world up to you, and it's fun.
That's Nancy Haker, a film location scout. A Day in the Work Life was produced by Klaus Andresen. Some people are scouting for help with their mortgage, and they're finding it at church.
For a lot of people, their only source of counsel that they feel they can count on is their pastor.
Up next, preaching the good book of foreclosure assistance. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Scott Jagow, in for Tess Figlin. The foreclosure notices are really starting to add up. Last month, one out of every 450 homes received one, and it's happening in every kind of neighborhood. But certain communities are suffering more than others. A recent study predicted that African Americans could lose up to $90 billion from foreclosures. As Janae Darden reports, some people are getting help from an unexpected source.
It's barely 8 a.m. in Inglewood, California, and beautician Lori Parker is already finished with her first client.
Thank you much.
Yep, see you. Parker is all smiles this morning. You wouldn't know a few months ago her home was on the brink of foreclosure.
Well, not knowing anything about the process, I did a refi a little earlier than I was supposed to.
In 2003, Parker bought a townhouse with a 30-year fixed mortgage. Over the next 5 years, she refinanced twice, and her mortgage payments jumped from $1,500 to $2,400 a month.
From then, it was just a downward spiral.
She fell behind on her payments, and in April, her lender started foreclosure proceedings. Parker, an African American, turned to her church for help. Yeah, you heard right.
I took the papers to people that I trusted.
Parker attends Center of Hope in Inglewood. It's part of a growing number of predominantly black churches around the country working with banks to help members stay in their homes.
In troubled times, people go to church. In troubled times, black folks go to church.
That's Larry Reed. He helps run the nonprofit Los Angeles Neighborhood Housing Services. It's working with Center of Hope and other churches.
For a lot of people, their only source of counsel that they feel they can count on is their pastor. So going through the churches, we will be able to reach all those folks who are having problems or questions with their mortgage.
I'm completely debt free.
Pastor George Thompson recently led a foreclosure workshop at his church, Faithful Central in Englewood. Thompson is also a financial consultant who travels the country speaking at black churches about money management. Earlier this year, he met with other black pastors to hammer out a plan with banks to reduce foreclosure in the black community.
The bank wants to educate people, but let's just be realistic right now. Sending mail to people telling them that you're late and can you please pay, that's not working.
The subprime mortgage meltdown has hit African American communities hard. The Federal Reserve reports that more than half of all mortgages issued to African Americans in 2005 were financed through risky subprime loans. That's compared to 17% for whites. Arna Fulcher directs Center of Hope's foreclosure prevention program.
Right now, we're looking at about maybe one in every eight or nine homeowners are approaching foreclosure or notices a default of some kind in our community. And that's an alarming number.
So alarming, Englewood officials are putting notices for the church's foreclosure clinics in residents' water bills. Lori Parker heard about one of the clinics and brought in her loan papers.
And they looked at it and they were like, okay, this is not a good loan.
Arna Fulcher says Parker is one of more than 100 people her program has counseled since the beginning of the year.
Basically, what we do is we try to help the banks do what are called rewrites of the existing loans or workouts, which is where they will come up with another workout plan for how they can refinance the property and get another payment cycle in place.
As for hairstylist Lori Parker, her financial counselors arranged a deal where she could stay in her home while the lender tried to sell it. She will have to leave soon, but she's leaving with some peace of mind.
I was one of those people that was ready to say, you know what, it's going to be a foreclosure. And I'm so glad that I didn't do that because, you know, now I have a buyer and I can walk away without a foreclosure on my record. You know, might not walk away with a lot of money in my pocket, but that's not even important.
Center of Hope will be busy for some time to come. Arna Fulcher says more adjustable rate mortgages are scheduled to reset in the next 6 to 8 months. I'm Janae Darden for Marketplace Money.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thriven Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider that offers products and planning tools to help their nearly 3 million members and their communities thrive. More at thriven.com. And by Constant Contact, dedicated to helping small businesses and nonprofits build stronger customer relationships through email marketing. ConstantContact.com.
We're back with more Getting Personal, where we answer your questions, and Chris Farrell is with us. Hi, Chris.
How you doing, Scott?
I'm doing okay. We're going to go to school now.
Ah.
Because our next caller is one of our younger listeners. She is 17 years old. Her name is Rachel. She joins us from Fort Collins, Colorado. Hi, Rachel.
Hi.
Are you studying economics or the stock market in school right now?
Actually, not really. The closest we've come is the Great Depression and the stock market class in history, but this is really an external interest of mine. Basically, I want to try investing. I don't know very much about it, so I was kind of hoping for advice on where to start. Prices are low, so.
Well, you got that part right. All right, we're getting somewhere now. Well, here's your opportunity to ask Chris your question. What would you like to ask him?
I have about $500 that I'm willing to put in, and I've heard about mutual funds, and I'm also interested in socially responsible investing, but I don't know very much about this, so.
Well, it's an interesting time to invest, and there's a couple of different ways to approach it. One thing, you're 17, right?
Yes.
Okay, so your parents will have to open up for you what's called a custodial account, which is very easy. Any place will do it for you, no problem. And then I have sort of two different approaches. I mean, one approach is take your $500 and, as you said, you know, buying a Standard & Poor's 500 equity index fund, which basically means you're just buying big companies, an index of big companies, low fees, and you'll ride it and see what happens.
And Chris, what kind of return might she expect on something like that?
Well, something like that, if you would expect off of the corporate profits that they're making over a long period of time, about a 6% return there. And then it depends on what dividends are above that. So if your dividends are averaging 1%, you'd expect like a 7% return over time. And then, of course, as you know, Scott and Rachel, you have to then subtract inflation from that calculation, whatever that's running at. But you're, you know, longer term, and then because you're buying now, you might do slightly better than that over the next couple of years.
There's nothing riding on this money, and I'm willing to leave it in there for a while. So,
the other idea, though, is to turn this into a little more fun and decide, you know, I really like X, some company, socially responsible company, some company that's out there doing something that you believe in. You may or may not make money off of it, but you'll turn it into that kind of a more of a learning experience, buying an individual stock, doing some research, and picking the stock. I have one other idea for you, Rachel. There are index funds that are socially responsible.
So you're talking about combining the two ideas here?
Combining the two ideas. So if you go to socialinvest.org, it's a really good source of information about socially responsible investing and the mutual funds, and you can research there. You're sort of satisfying, I think, two criteria. And one, you're sort of taking a bet on the market, sort of a broad-based look at the market rather than an individual stock. But you're moving into the socially responsible universe, which I think is a very important and wonderful thing to do.
Rachel, what do you think? Does that sound exciting?
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to this. And that's basically what I'm looking at this as, just an experiment.
Well, so maybe you put some of it in the fund, and then you pick one company and give it a shot, see what happens. Are you thinking of majoring in business?
It's very undecided right now, but that is a possible option.
All right. Well, good luck with whatever you decide to do.
Thank you very much.
Well, that's pretty impressive, Chris, someone that young thinking about investing.
It's very impressive, and I wish more people would do that, because looking at the stock market as a learning experience is just a wonderful attitude to take, and it's a lifelong learning experience.
Our next question comes via email from Scott in San Diego. Scott is 22, and he's a part-time architecture student. He says he's going to receive an inheritance of a few properties, all of which are paid off. Sounds great. They add up to $1 million. Sounds even better. Sounds like a windfall. But what he wants to know is, will this reduce or cancel his federal student financial aid? He works part-time and barely makes enough to pay for his education and expenses, and he can't sell the property because it must stay in the family. Chris, what do you think? Is this a lucky break, or could it be a big problem?
I'm going to put that in the lucky break category. And no, it will not cancel his federal student aid. But there's a couple of things that he should do. The first thing that he should do is recognize he's going to fill out that form called FAFSA. That's the basic financial aid form. But before he does, contact his school. Talk to the financial aid people and say, look, you know, I have this property, but I can't borrow against it, because that's what they're going to come back and say, can you borrow against it? And I can't sell it. Can you work with me? Can you make an exception? Where should I put this in the financial aid form? Where would you like me to put it? If he is straight up with them, very straightforward, they'll work with him and get their reaction, but you're still going to be able to get financial aid. It may reduce it a little bit. It definitely is not going to cancel it.
Well, once again, we've run out of time for questions for this week's show, but you can call us anytime. It's 877-275-6669, 877-ASK-MONY, and leave your question. We'll get back to you. The Getting Personal link at marketplace.org is also a place where you can leave your questions. And check out Chris's blog for more questions and answers while you're on marketplace.org. Chris?
Scott, it's been great.
This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. What are you doing? That's a question we've been asking on all the Marketplace shows. We're hoping to get a sense of how people adapt in a down economy. Today, we step onto the gangplank in Portland, Oregon. There, we found an ex-Navy man who runs a tour boat company. What's he doing? Looking for a little Christmas spirit.
I'm Dan Yates, president of Portland Spirit Cruises in Portland, Oregon. We cruise a tremendous amount of the Columbia and the Willamette River. So over the course of a year, we'll do about 2,000 cruises. December is a very large month for us for corporate Christmas parties. When they have a good year, they do something extravagant. When they have a so-so year, they do something less extravagant. And this has not been, we're looking for a cheaper alternative. This is, we are not going to do anything. We cannot do this. Just sheer panic. And I thought it would stop after November 1st, this cancellation mania, because we have our final contracts for the holiday season are due November 1st. But it's carried on even through to yesterday. We had a large party that just kind of woke up and realized that they have a big event coming up in December and they don't feel comfortable doing it. We've gone from being 2 or 3, 4% ahead, and as of yesterday, we're about 20+% behind. We're having our holiday party in about 10 days, and it's probably going to be one of our biggest ones we've had because I don't believe in cutting back on that. And I think it's pretty short-sighted to miss an opportunity for a president of a company to say thank you to your employees. You can't tell your employees thank you enough.
That's Dan Yates with Here's What I'm Doing. It's part of our coverage of the financial crisis fallout. Lots more online at marketplace.org. Usually this time of year, the party planning committee is in full swing, preparing for the office bash.
What do we got? What do we got? How many plates are we getting?
50.
Ooh, double it. Double everything. Double ice cream, double napkins, double it. On me. I want people to cut loose. I want people making out in closets. I want people hanging from the ceilings, lampshades on the heads. I want it to be a Playboy Mansion party.
It's not going to happen this year. As you just heard, riverboat cruises are out, and you can forget about ice sculptures and champagne. You'll be lucky to get a potluck. Joe Bennett is with the executive search firm Battaglia Winston Amrop. Every year they do a survey about corporate holiday events. Joe, thanks for coming on the program.
Thank you, Scott.
I will tell you that I'm wearing a Grinch t-shirt today just for this interview.
Well, that's very appropriate.
That's what I hear based on what this survey is telling us. So tell us what the details of it are.
Well, we've been surveying companies for 20 years now, and each year the number is pretty much consistent. Most companies have holiday parties. The last time, though, that we saw a big drop-off in holiday parties was after 9/11, and that has now been topped by 2008 when only 81% of companies are planning to have holiday parties.
I'm surprised it's that many.
Well, actually, I think it's going to be less because since we did the survey back in October, a number of companies have changed their minds and have decided to cancel their parties.
Now, some companies are canceling their parties even though they've already paid for them. Is this true?
Well, they haven't paid for the whole party. What they've done is put down a deposit, and they will lose their deposits. But the real reason that they're not doing parties is not purely because of the cost. It just doesn't set the right tone. We've seen a lot of layoffs. We've seen people taking bailout money. We've seen all kinds of disasters in the last few weeks.
Yeah, it's just kind of an image thing, I assume, for a company if it's throwing this huge bash, especially, you know, a company on Wall Street.
Well, if you're taking the taxpayers' money, you really can't put on a lavish celebration for yourself.
One of the other things I wanted to ask you about was bonuses, end-of-year holiday bonuses, whatever you want to call it. There are a lot of people out there angry about what has happened with the bailouts, and they want these companies to eliminate bonuses altogether. Can you explain a little bit about how the bonus versus salary structure works?
In the financial services industry, people are paid artificially low base salaries. So, for example, you might get $150,000 base salary if you're a vice president at a major money center bank, but your bonus could easily be $700,000 or $800,000. And the dollars go all the way down the chain in these firms. I mean, even people in administrative assistant positions in some of the financial services institutions also have come to rely on getting a big bonus.
Why do financial companies do it this way?
That's a very good question. I haven't been able to figure it out. I think they originally thought that it would help them keep their fixed cost low so that in bad times they just wouldn't have to put out money on salaries. And I think probably what's going to happen is that the compensation system in the financial services industry is going to have to be modified to be more like that in normal corporate America. They have really, I think, grossly overpaid themselves in good times. And in bad times, they basically have to fire everybody.
As we've seen, unfortunately, the last few months.
And that's another reason why nobody wants to have a holiday party when all of your, you know, many colleagues that you have known for years are, you know, out in the job market. It's hard to feel like celebrating.
Okay, Jo Bennett. She's a partner with Battaglia Winston Amrop, an executive recruiting firm in New York. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Scott.
You're a vile one, Mr. Grinch. You have termites in your smile. You have all the tender sweetness of a seasick crocodile, Mr. Grinch.
That's Marketplace Money for this week. Next time, most people would say with a good education, you'll find a good career. But what if your classroom is solely on the internet? Would you think the same way?
I'm pretty sure I'm going to have a decent job when I'm done.
Marketplace Money is produced by Jim Wallace, Stephen Hoffman, Eve Troh, and the rest of the Marketplace staff. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yore. Remember, talk to your own expert before you make any big money decisions. I'm Scott Jagow. We'll see you next week.
Want to hear something on Marketplace Money again? Help is as near as your home computer. To find audio archives of past programs and information on transcripts, just go to the internet and log on to our website. The information you need when you need it is only a few clicks away. Just point your browser to marketplace.org. Marketplace Money is supported by Thriven Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider that offers products and planning tools to help their nearly 3 million members and their communities thrive. More at thriven.com.
American Public Media.